Robin Hood Radio and the Robin Hood Radio Network is proud to present Leonard Lopate at Large, lively hour-long in-depth discussions providing overviews and context to topics usually covered in partial measures. His guests include leading thinkers, scientists, artists, economists, farmers, historians, authors, and politicians. Mr. Lopate is a Peabody Award winner whose numerous honors include 3 Associated Press Awards and 3 James Beard Awards.
Welcome to Leonard Lopate at Large. I'm Leonard Lopate. According to an eye-opening new documentary called Invisible Hands, there are over 200 million children around the world producing many of the foods, clothing, and other products that we use every day. The film looks at the prevalence of child labor, child trafficking, and even child slavery within the supply chains of some of the world's largest corporations, and also highlights efforts to abolish these practices. It opens in New York at the Cinema Village on November 23rd, and I'm pleased to welcome the film's director, Tracy Tandon, to our show now. Hello.
Hi, thank you for having me.
Isn't this your first feature film as a director?
It is. It is my first feature
documentary. What a topic to choose to start with.
I know, just your average date night chick flick.
So why did you choose something so complicated to tackle as your first subject?
Well, Leonard, I've been a journalist throughout my career for almost a decade now, and working in television news reporting. And I've met so many fascinating characters, people, whether it's politicians or Nobel laureates or even small business owners, refugees. And a lot of the people that I used to come across and the stories that I used to encounter, I used to think they deserve more than just a 3 or 4 minute news segment on the 24-hour churn and burn news cycle, that some characters are just worth living with for much longer than that.
The philosophy of this show as well.
Yeah, we are kindred spirits, you and I. And that really manifested itself in an interview that I did a few years ago at the United Nations General Assembly when I was interviewing the Nobel Peace Prize winner, Kailash Satyarthi. Mm. For those of you who are unfamiliar with him, he shared his Nobel Peace Prize win with Malala Yousafzai of Pakistan. Quite funny, because I think it's the first time you can have India and Pakistan and the word peace in the same sentence. And Kailash, over the last 35 years, has rescued over 87,000 children from child labor and child trafficking, predominantly in South Asia, but his work spans, you know, to over 80 countries around the world. And so that really was what sparked the idea of this film.
He conducts raids on factories to rescue children.
Yes.
Has he been successful in reducing child labor in India?
Substantially. He's rescued, you know, that 87,000 figure, that's predominantly stems from the work that he's done across India.
We'll come back to him in a little bit, but I want to go back to something more of an overview. You look at child labor practices in countries, not just India, but also Indonesia, China, Ghana, Congo, Mexico, and even the United States. Mm-hmm. How do you go researching something like this?
Well, as a filmmaker, the good news is that we had so many countries to pick from. The bad news is, where do you draw the line?
And the bad news is you have so many countries to pick from
also,
when you're talking about this.
Yes. So we decided that we were going to tackle a few countries in Asia, a few countries in Africa, and definitely the United States, because that for me was the real eye-opener. Because when we think of sort of human rights abuses and we think of child labor, child trafficking, we're all so quick to say, oh, that's an Asia problem or that's an Africa problem. Little do we know, that's an America problem.
Is it difficult to get access to the farms and factories where these practices are occurring? How do you convince the owners of these places to allow you to inspect their premises and film in them?
A lot of the times you don't inform them. So there's a lot of covert filming. There were a lot of body cameras that we used to get in and out of places and factories and farms. And in countries like India and Indonesia and even parts of Africa, people don't think they're doing anything wrong or illegal. It's a combination of poverty and being illiterate. Because at the end of the day, these are farm managers and factory managers that are on the ground, not corporate CEOs or CFOs.
And also, they are just doing what their people have been doing for a long, long time in their countries.
Yes, exactly.
But the negative effects of child labor seem kind of obvious. Lack of education, which leads to lifelong poverty and serious health problems. You'd think that the governments would be doing things to prevent it from becoming so widespread.
Absolutely. It's a bit of a double-edged sword because on the one hand, they do want to allow child labor to continue because it allows companies to really keep their costs down, their sort of unaccounted laborers that, you know, aren't on the payroll, and oftentimes they get paid little to absolutely nothing. But the flip side is also, as you pointed out, that it does perpetuate poverty. But children don't feature in the minds of government officials and politicians. They don't vote. They don't have a voice. They're not really contributing to the economy at this stage.
And they don't have labor unions, so they can't complain about dangerous labor conditions.
No. And they're none the wiser.
They just think this is what life is?
Yes. And
partly because their parents are often complicit in their situation.
Yes. I don't like the word complicit because I don't think the parents really also know what the alternative is for their child. There's a lack of schoolings in a lot of the villages and education systems, which is one of the things we talk about in our film is, you know, if you're going to, if companies, the big corporations are going to use the resources on the ground, they ought to open schools so that the kids have places to go to rather than standing in a field with a machete in their hand.
One of the areas the film focuses on is tobacco production. Is this an area where child labor is especially prevalent?
In the United States, it is. In the U.S., child labor is widespread in the agricultural sector in this country. And you know, without getting into too much of the nitty-gritty, the United States is also the only advanced country in the world that has not ratified United Nations conventions on minimum age laws.
So you have you interviewed teenagers working in tobacco production in the United States, and they describe working long hours under horrible conditions and getting sick from exposure to nicotine. Now, just working with nicotine can make you sick?
Absolutely. So nicotine is water soluble. So when you touch the tobacco leaves on a farm, the nicotine actually enters your body through your skin. So you don't have to smoke a cigarette in order to get green tobacco sickness or nicotine poisoning.
And it's a poisoning?
It is a poisoning.
What does it do to your body?
It's extremely toxic. It can cause severe vomiting, nausea, fever, chills. There are kids who've been hospitalized because the cotinine level, the cotinine is a chemical compound that takes place in your body when you get into, when you have contact with nicotine, the cotinine levels in their system are higher than pack-a-day smokers who are non-tobacco farm workers.
And it's just because they're handling the tobacco leaves? It comes in through their skin?
Yes, handling tobacco leaves for anywhere between 8 to 12 hours every day.
You say that some of the symptoms they have include vomiting, respiratory problems, and also long-term consequences like neurological development. So it affects the way these children actually, their brains develop?
Yes, there have been doctors who study farm workers in the United States, and that is one of the things that they have discovered.
Not just children, but it can happen to anybody who's working in tobacco.
Right, but when you are 10 years old and you are still growing and developing, surely the effects are much more severe on a child.
Do the plantation owners provide them with protective clothing? In the film, we see children in Indonesia working on tobacco plantations, and they actually start earlier than the U.S. kids?
They do start earlier. They're 6-year-olds harvesting tobacco in Indonesia, and the tobacco is bought by all the big tobacco companies around the world. Philip Morris, British American Tobacco, Imperial, Reynolds, American tobacco companies are also buying the tobacco that these five-year-old children in Indonesia are harvesting.
Did you try to interview representatives of Philip Morris and British American Tobacco about these conditions?
Oh, yes, we did. A lot of our phone calls and emails went unanswered, and the Reynolds, American, R.J. Reynolds, they reached out and said that they would not be commenting on camera.
Doesn't Indonesia have laws regulating child labor?
They do. Indonesia actually has much stronger child labor laws in agriculture than the United States. So in Indonesia, you have to be at least 17 years or older in order to work in the fields. However, the problem is that a lot of these fields and farms go unaudited and unregulated.
So they don't send inspectors to check it out conveniently?
They are supposed to. Those laws do exist on the books. But in the almost 2 months that we were there, not a single labor inspector had been on any of the farms that we were at.
I guess that's a problem of a country with good labor laws, but no enforcement.
It's all bark, no bite.
Now, let's talk a bit about the U.S. laws in this regard. We have child labor laws. Why don't they apply to kids working in tobacco?
Because in tobacco in this country is not deemed as hazardous. So despite all the enormous evidence that we have from doctors, scientists, researchers, farm workers, union leaders, tobacco in this country is still deemed as a non-hazardous occupation. Therefore, if something is not hazardous, then that means that minimum age of 18 is not set. And so kids, you know, up to the age of 10, 11, 12 are able to work.
And that's in every state of the United States?
Every state of the United States.
Because I would have thought, for example, a liberal state like California might have stricter laws, but I gather there's a lot of child labor in the farms to some degree because their parents often bring them to help.
Yes, absolutely. You know, parents often have children working on the farms, family farms, small-owned farms, but even commercial farms, you have these kids working. And California, you see a lot of the children working on the fields picking berries, blueberries, strawberries. And that's really not an issue for the most part if they're just doing it for a couple of hours. But what we end up seeing that really happens is these kids do work long hours, 10, 12-hour days over the holidays. In some cases, they miss school in order to work and help their families out. And in many cases, they're exposed to toxic, dangerous pesticides, insecticides, chemicals. They're using heavy machinery, handling dangerous equipment, tractors. Workplace injuries are very common.
And one of the better known of those pesticides is
chlorpyrifos.
Pyrifos. Dow Chemical gave us that. Wasn't this insecticide about to be banned by the EPA until President Trump reversed that ban?
Absolutely. I'm so happy you brought this up because it's such an interesting topic. So chlorpyrifos is actually a pesticide that is used in agricultural farming in this country, and it's banned on several other continents because of just how dangerous it is. It affects brain development. It makes you physically and also it makes you mentally and physically ill. And the Obama administration had put in extremely tough laws on chlorpyrifos, essentially working towards banning it. And then the then CEO of Dow Chemical manufactures this pesticide, Andrew Liveris, donated $1 million to President Trump's campaign. And a few months after Trump took power, Andrew Liveris was standing next to him while President Trump lifted the restrictions, signed an executive order removing restrictions from chlorpyrifos.
I assume that also applies to adults working in the fields.
Yes.
Absolutely.
It's made adults.
But are children
well.
more likely to be affected simply because their immune systems are not as well developed?
Yes. Their immune systems are not well developed. They're still growing physically, mentally, psychologically, neurologically.
Can't they be provided with protective clothing?
It is up to the child and the parents to provide that for the children, which is really unfortunate because neither the companies nor the farms offer that sort of protective gear.
You said you try to speak to some of the big tobacco manufacturers about these conditions. What about legislators?
Again, no one would speak to us. We even reached out to the Department of Labor to comment, and it was crickets.
I'm speaking with Shraisi, S-H-R-A-Y-S-I, Tandon, who has directed a new film called Invisible Hands about child labor around the world. I quit smoking some years ago, so I can't feel guilty personally about what we've just been discussing. But I wonder about some of the other products that I rely on to in my everyday life. Should I assume that child labor might have gone into something that I ate or something that a soap or something else that I used or something that I might be wearing right now?
Yes, quite possibly. It is.
That was a leading question, wasn't it? I'm sorry.
It's, you know, one of the things that I learned during the making of this film, Leonard, is just how many products and items in our house, in our cupboards, in our food is touched by child labor. And as you rightly pointed out, it could be the shirt on our backs, it could be the meal that we just ate, or even the products that we used to take a shower this morning.
Well, getting back to Indonesia, a country that you spent time in when you were young?
I grew up there, yes.
So were you aware of that, any of this when you were there?
No, I wasn't. And I'll tell you why. It's because when you're growing up in a country, you do live in a little bubble in of whatever town or city you are in. And very rarely do you venture out into the outskirts of the city to go really see what's happening. The only indication of any sort of form of child labor that I used to see in the country was when I used to go to local cafeterias or restaurants and I would see disturbingly young children serving coffee or tea or even your bowl of noodles.
Although that happens here as well.
That does. And you don't think anything of it. Somehow it just feels like it's
they're working
part of the
for
culture.
Their parents.
Yes.
Learning the business.
Yes.
In Indonesia, you looked at the palm oil industry, actually in Sumatra, yeah. one of the major islands. Isn't palm oil one of the things that we may not even realize that we are consuming?
Yes, although if you look at the ingredients on the back of any product you pick up, whether it's your soap or shampoo or even a food item, you will see palm oil listed if you look for it. And palm oil is essentially used in foods and in soaps and shampoos. The primary purpose of palm oil is really to extend shelf life. So that box of chocolates or that bag of cookies can sit in your pantry for sometimes up to a year.
Or potato chips?
Yes.
Crackers? You say it's in toothpaste?
It is in toothpaste, yes. And it helps make the suds more soapier or much more foamier in toothpaste.
And you mentioned shampoo. I assume it works that way there as well. How are children used in palm oil production?
So the children are essentially harvesting the palm fruit, which if you've never seen a palm fruit before, imagine a really big, round, prickly watermelon. And some of these things can weigh up to 50, 60 pounds for just one fruit.
And a kid is harvesting that?
A kid is harvesting it, and they're riding around in these little mini tractors, and you'll see two or three kids at a time trying to pick these things up and load them onto the back of their mini tractor.
Aren't they helping their parents harvest the palm fruit?
No, the parents in Indonesia do not own most of those palm plantations. Those palm plantations are controlled by either the government or the large corporations.
I heard that the palm oil workers have daily quotas that even their bosses acknowledge is impossible to reach. So unless they bring their kids with them, they won't be able to make their quotas.
Absolutely. A lot of the farm workers have a quota that they need to harvest 50 or 60 palm fruit a day, whatever the number it is that is set by the managers. And one person working 8 to 10 hours a day on a farm simply is unable to meet that. And so oftentimes they will bring their children to help them so they can reach that quota and earn a little bit of extra money.
You have filmed the children spraying pesticides from backpacks that they carry with no protective gear.
Yes.
If the companies supplied the kids with gloves, masks, or helmets, would that be an admission that they're actually using child labor?
Absolutely. The companies don't even want to offer them even working boots, because by doing so, what are they going to do? Go buy a size 4 pair of shoes? I mean, that would be really admission of wrongdoing on their part.
You focus on a company called Wilmar, which may not be familiar to most people, but aren't they the major supplier of palm oil to some pretty big companies? Procter & Gamble, Unilever, Colgate, Palmolive?
Yes, Wilmar is one of the largest palm oil suppliers in the entire world. They are based in Singapore, and their clients include, as you said, Unilever, Nestle, Procter & Gamble. Yeah.
And I'm assuming that you called those companies to find out whether you could talk to any of the people who would know about these conditions.
We did not reach out to Wilmar, because we knew that a lot of the filming that we had to do in the palm oil plantations in Sumatra had to be extremely quiet and covert. And so by calling them and asking them to comment would mean in some shape or form we would be tipping them off as to what it is that we were trying to do.
And why would that be bad? Because exposure, obviously, might lead to a change in policy.
Absolutely. The companies, you know, they're publicly traded firm. They have shareholders and investors, and they don't want to risk any corporate reputational damage.
So Procter & Gamble wouldn't talk to you?
Procter & Gamble wrote to us to say that they would not comment. And we reached out to their director of supply chain management, who is essentially responsible for making sure that they are monitoring and cleaning up their supply chains. And crickets again. There was a lot of that happened during the making of this film, which did not surprise any of us.
Another industry you look at is cocoa production in Ghana. Now, I learned in school that cocoa is indigenous to Mesoamerica. So what happened with Ghana? Is Ghana a major supplier of cocoa?
It is. So Ghana and Côte d'Ivoire, which we also know as the Ivory Coast, together they are the world's largest cocoa suppliers. They account for 60% of the world's cocoa production. And so all the big chocolate companies, Nestle, Hershey's, Cadbury, Lindt, Sprungli, they all buy cocoa from both of these countries.
Are there a lot of children working in the cocoa
plantations? Oh, a lot. And
we're calling them plantations. We don't call American farms plantations, and I guess not since the Civil War, but would what we'd find here also be called plantations if they weren't in the United States?
I think, you know, when people use the word plantation, there is that connotation of slave labor. Mm-hmm. And at least in my research, I know that modern-day slavery is all around us. But from our experience, we didn't find any forced labor in American farms, in farms across the U.S. However, the word plantation would be absolutely correct for farms in Ghana and Côte d'Ivoire, because there you do have slave labor and trafficked children working.
These children have been trafficked from neighboring countries like Nigeria and Burkina Faso.
And Mali.
What is that? So are they kidnapped? And
a lot of the times they are tricked. So there is kidnapping that takes place. From our experience, what we learned is that the children and their parents were duped into thinking that they were going to be working for a few hours every day, harvesting cocoa, and that they would be earning $100 a month or something, whatever the figure was at the time. I believe it was $100, at least the equivalent, and that the parents would be receiving a large portion of that money.
And their kids would be receiving an education.
And they're doing a little bit of work. When they weren't working, yes. Seems like the Ghanaian dream when you get sold that story.
Doesn't Ghana have a government agency called the Cocoa Board?
They do.
What do they do?
Not much. They are supposed to. They are supposed to be there to inspect the cocoa farms. They are supposed to be there to make sure that the farms across the country are following labor laws. Again, Ghana has child labor laws on their books. I don't have the figures in front of me. I believe the minimum age for child labor in Ghana is 15. And the Cocoa Board is supposed to be sending inspectors and auditors on a regular basis to inspect these farms. However, none of that's happening. In fact, some of the farms that we filmed on, when we asked the managers, when was the last time an auditor from the Cocoa Board came to your farm? They said 10 years ago. They said once in 10 years. And I asked them, what did they do when they showed up? They were just making sure that the farmers were using the correct pesticides and insecticides and that the farm was yielding maximum production. And that was it. Everything else was, I guess they just turned a blind eye to everything else.
Because it helps the Ghanaian economy. In fact, all of these countries obviously see this in economic terms, not in terms of the welfare of children.
Absolutely. You have a small Western, West African country that is supplying cocoa to giant corporations like Nestle, Hershey's, Cadbury, Lindt. The last thing you want to do is rock the boat and jeopardize all the revenue that these companies are bringing into your country.
Didn't you interview the head of PR at Nestle?
I did. Christian Frutiger is the head of public relations for Nestle, based in Switzerland. And I was very surprised when they agreed to do the interview.
What were you told?
We were told that they were aware to some degree of trafficked children working in cocoa production, but that as far as they were concerned, it was something that had been cleaned up years ago. And at current, they're not so sure that this is still happening.
And you were told their products are responsibly sourced to the extent possible, whatever that means. So they're claiming there's no way for them to know if child labor is used in growing the cocoa that they buy, in effect?
I find that very hard to believe. You have a team of journalists and filmmakers who show up in Ghana and are there for a few weeks and find in every instance, in every farm that they go to, that there are children, forced laborers, trafficked children, child laborers from neighboring villages, all working there. I think if you just looked a little harder, you would find what it is you're looking for. I believe they are just not interested.
It's obvious you didn't have to look all that hard to find them.
No,
because
I didn't.
You filmed kids working in all of these different places.
Absolutely. I mean, they're all on camera. If you watch the movie, you will see exactly what it is we're talking about.
Couldn't Nestle's or Hershey send somebody to inspect the working conditions in these farms and then insisted that they be improved?
Yes, absolutely. And that's one of the things that, you know, a lot of the experts that we spoke to say that companies ought to start doing, which is sending their own auditors and labor inspectors into these countries where they operate. And setting aside an entire sort of arm, a division, or a budget for this to happen, and not rely on small, squeezed government agencies to do their auditing and inspecting for them. Because you can bribe these government officials very easily. You know, if you want a gold star on your auditing report, they don't even have to show up. All you have to do is mail a check sometimes.
I'm speaking with Tracy Tandon, the director of a film about child labor around the world called Invisible Hands. I would assume that if you could find all of these things, that there are any number of NGOs out there that would also be finding them. Why is this not discussed more?
There are so many issues in the world that people are covering, and this is certainly one of them. And I think it's really just a matter of taking your pick, you know. You can talk about environmental abuses, you can talk about...
But these are environmental abuses.
These, to an extent, yes. Yes, I would classify it as, you know, human rights issues, you know, but... You know, Leonard, the media focuses on things that are sort of burning at the moment, which is whether it's the Rohingya crisis or the refugee crisis or the warming of the world, climate change. Child labor, child trafficking is not a new phenomenon. It's been going on for centuries. You know, we when we think of child labor and child trafficking and slavery, we often think about those black and white or sepia photos from 100 years ago.
Did you get to speak with representatives of any other companies other than Nestle that rely on these raw materials like tobacco, palm oil, or cocoa? No?
No, we didn't. Nestle is the only corporation that we were able to speak to on camera. A lot of the other conversations that we had were off the record, off camera.
They claim that they have a multi-layered supply chain, so they really just don't know exactly where their materials are coming from.
Absolutely, and that's a huge problem, is some of the corporations don't even know the geographical locations of where their products are being manufactured from. Let alone who their supplier is, because all they focus on is their immediate tier one supplier. But oftentimes, in many cases, there's multi-layer tier two, tier three, there's subcontractors involved.
Are we talking about something we can appreciate, or is there a willful ignorance here?
Willful ignorance is certainly the phrase, yes.
Wasn't there an effort made in the U.S. Congress to enact a law, the Harkin-Engel Protocol, to prevent child labor in the cocoa industry?
Yes. So Senator Tom Harkin and Representative, you know, Congressman Elliot Engel, over a decade ago, I would say 15 years ago now, they tried
20
to.
20 years ago, almost. 2001.
There you go.
So what is that, 17 years
ago? 17 years ago was when they enacted the Harkin-Engel Protocol, which is they wanted to stop child slavery in the cocoa plantations that were reaching chocolates that American adults and children were buying and consuming every day.
Did it pass?
No. In fact, it got delayed, and every couple of years, the big chocolate companies would come together and say, you know, in the next 3 years, we're going to address this. In the next 4 years, we're going to clean this up. In the next 5 years, we're going to clean this up. And so it just kept getting pushed back. And today, nothing has happened.
Well, we can't blame this on partisan politics, because over those years since 2001, Congress and the White House have been controlled by both Republicans and Democrats.
Yes, this is a bipartisan issue. Absolutely.
Do we know if that bill had been passed, if it would have made any difference in the use of child labor in the cocoa industry? What did it call for?
You know, I think it's better to have a bill passed and have laws on the books than to have no laws on the books at all. At least it gives you an incentive. It incentivizes those who want to do good and want to enact those laws to be able to have something to back them. For there to be nothing on the table, I don't think that's the way to go.
In Ghana, you worked with an investigative journalist named Anas Armayo Anas, who always wears disguises. And in the film, we see him with a bead curtain over his face. Has he been looking into child labor and child trafficking in the cocoa industry?
Yes. So Anas Armayo Anas, and also known as Anas Anas, is a very fascinating character who's in our film. He's become a very dear friend of mine, and President Obama actually called him one of the most important investigative journalists in modern history. For those of you who are interested in learning more about him, the BBC has done a documentary on Anas called The Chameleon. And Anas, over the course of his career as an investigative journalist, has always been in disguise because of the places and the countries he operates in across the continent of Africa.
Didn't you also go undercover posing as cocoa plantation owners looking for child workers?
Yes, we teamed up with Anas to help us find traffickers who were selling children to cocoa plantations and cocoa farms.
How old were the children you were offered?
We bought two sets of children, four at a time. The youngest child was 12 and the oldest was 16.
And how much were you paying for them?
$150 US per head.
But I hear that in some cases you get them for as little as $35.
That's what we heard too. However, we were charged premium for whatever reason.
And how much are the children paid?
Little to nothing.
They sign a contract and they're told that they'll be paid once the contract is up 10 years later?
Yes. There's no signing of a contract. It's a verbal agreement, and they're told that they will be paid a couple of $100 for their work. However, what we found out is that the children don't get paid until they end up serving, quote-unquote, their time. And so their time could be 5 years, sometimes 10 years.
Were you able to bring in the police and have the traffickers arrested?
Yes, we were.
What happened?
We worked with the Ghanaian police commissioner as well as the anti-trafficking authorities and told them about what we were doing. And we said that the next time we set up a meeting with the trafficker, we would like them there and we would like the trafficker arrested. And we also worked with social services to make sure that the children were returned
to their parents, their families.
Yes.
What kinds of sentences did the traffickers get?
The court case is still going on, but he faces between 10 to 20 years in prison.
Well, at least that's some advance.
Yes.
Another area is mining. Where children are used, and you look at cobalt mines in the Democratic Republic of Congo. Cobalt is used in electronics, like phones and computers, so it's become really valuable. Didn't Amnesty International find that children as young as 4 were working in the mines? How could a 4-year-old work in a mine?
I mean, do you remember what you were doing at the age of 4? I
was learning how to read.
And ride your bicycle.
Not well.
Yes, same. Just the idea that a 4-year-old is mining cobalt, and this cobalt in the DRC, so the Democratic Republic of Congo is one of the largest cobalt producers in the world, and the cobalt goes into our smartphones, into our laptops, into the lithium-ion batteries that are powering the electronics around our house, and even in car companies, you know, the likes of Tesla.
Is anything being done to stop that practice?
There are a lot of companies that have pledged that they are going to stop purchasing cobalt from the DRC. But that's not enough to just put a temporary suspension on buying cobalt. You need further action.
And then you looked at child labor practices in the world's second largest economy, China. Mm-hmm. Didn't China enact mandatory primary education in the 1990s? So I would assume that would have reduced the use of child labor.
Absolutely. And, you know, oftentimes when we think of human rights abuses, and I'm not saying China is perfect, they have a very questionable track record when it comes to human rights, but mostly for adult workers, not so much for children. Ever since they instated this mandatory primary school education across the country, child labor has significantly reduced. So child labor, when I started working on this film, I thought, oh boy, China, here we come. This is where I'm going to find the most of it. But I was very pleasantly surprised to see how little of that was taking place in China.
But they do get around it by having student internships that are really just manual labor in a factory.
Yes. So they found a very sort of tricky or loophole in which they do hire children to work at factories.
And you interviewed some of the children working in an appliance factory. Do they realize that they're being exploited?
All the children realize that they're being exploited. They all talk about it in our film. However, they have no choice, because if they don't work at these factories for a few months in the year, they will not graduate from high school. And so it's sort of mandatory for them to stand in a factory line, putting together parts of an appliance or air conditioner or washing machine.
Wow. I could see some entrepreneurial American junior high or high school deciding to make the classes in shop an opportunity to actually build air conditioners.
Yeah, absolutely. And a lot of the times the children are told that this is going to add value to whatever it is that they're going to study for in the future. But a child looking to, be a math teacher has no business standing there in a factory line assembling air conditioners.
We began by talking about India and the 2014 Nobel Prize winner, Kailash Satyarthi. How many child laborers are there in India?
The numbers vary. I would say between anywhere from 50 to 100 million. We're not even sure.
So this may be the largest?
It's a combination between sub-Saharan Africa and South Asia. And when I say South Asia, I'm talking India, Bangladesh, Nepal.
And what industries use child labor there?
Predominantly, the agricultural industry across the world is where child labor is rife, mining as well. However, also in a little bit in garments, textiles, accessories, footwear.
Because those kinds of things, for those kinds of things, small fingers might be an asset.
Absolutely.
Embroidery, jewelry production.
Yeah, that's where you see a lot of the children doing a lot of the embroidery work in the garment manufacturing business. They're not, actually manufacturing using the yarn to actually produce the textile and the garment. What they're doing is a lot of the embroidery and design work.
Are there child labor laws in India?
There are child labor laws in India. Yes, they are. So India has ratified the United Nations Convention on minimum age in child labor. However, it's a country of 1.2 billion people and a lot of rural land and very little inspecting and auditing.
Kailash Satyarthi started a refuge for former child workers that's called Bal Ashram. Mm-hmm. What are its goals?
Bal Ashram, I spent some time there a year ago, and it's like a sanctuary for children. It's a place that if you walk into, you would probably wish that you lived there too. It's essentially a boarding school for rescued child laborers and trafficked children in India. And so they offer educational, it's a proper school, and they also offer recreational days and evenings such as sports, meditation, yoga, learning to sing, learning to paint. All of their children graduate from school and they all go on to go to college.
This is a way of reversing the effects of the years of forced labor and abuse on these kids?
Absolutely, giving them a second chance at life. And beyond just, the educational and the recreational activities and the learning, a lot of the children are also given counseling and psychological sort of treatments.
I'm assuming they also have health problems.
They do. We did come across kids who had, who were very... who were injured because of a lot of the workplace accidents that they encountered, children who had deformed legs because from the age of six, they were squatting in the corner, stitching and packing jeans. And so after 12 hours a day, 5-6 years of doing that, now as 12 or 13 year olds, a lot of them, their legs have just completely deformed. And you don't think about these things when you think about child laborers. But another thing that I want to talk about, Leonard, really briefly, is a lot of people don't often associate sexual abuse with child labor as well. And
if you're trafficking in children, sexual abuse seems to be almost a component of that.
It's a massive component. And, when a child is trafficked, the child is trafficked for two reasons. Either they're trafficked for the sex trade and for sexual exploitation, or they're trafficked for labor purposes. But in the case of sexual exploitation, oftentimes the child is not then used as a child laborer. But the children who are trafficked for labor purposes are almost always also sexually exploited.
Does it matter whether they're boys or girls?
It doesn't matter. So there's a lot of sodomy amongst the boys, and the girls are, you know, not just sexually harassed, and they're molested as well. And it's both their reward and their punishment. So if they do great work, that's the reward they receive. And if they perform poorly as laborers, that's their punishment as well.
I'd imagine these, many of them are scarred for life as a result. I'm talking about emotionally as well as physically.
I can't even begin to imagine the trauma that these kids have to endure. That's why in a lot of these rehabilitation places, such as Kailash Satyarthi's Bal Ashram, there are counselors and psychologists present to treat these children.
Kailash also has an organization called Goodweave. What do they do?
Goodweave is a company. It was formerly called Rugmark, and it started because they wanted to create a labeling system in the carpet industry. So the carpet industry for decades has also had significant problems with trafficked children, modern slavery, debt bondage, indentured labor. And so they wanted to create a labeling system that for just a few cents more per carpet, which is what it will cost the consumer, can they have a labeling system where they can be, you know, create some sort of assurance that that carpet is not made by forced labor or child labor? And that's where he teamed up with a group of NGOs and carpet manufacturers to create the label Goodweave. So I think the final cost to a consumer is less than $2 is what the price of that carpet is, $2 more than what you would pay for a comparative carpet. But any carpet that has a Goodweave label is something that you can guarantee is forced labor free.
It says child labor free. Mm-hmm. I'm wondering about when it's the family business. I know of a wonderful carpet maker outside of Oaxaca. It's a multi-generational business, the grandparents, the parents, and now the kids want to get involved as well. When it's not coerced, when it's something that they just do because that's part of the culture of the family, is that the same thing?
That's really interesting. I don't think it's the same thing at all. I think, I think in those situations, the parents are present. It's voluntary. They are maybe spending a few hours a week learning the ropes or helping their parents. It's not at the cost of their education. It's not at the cost of their mental and physical well-being. And they're lining the pockets of these multinational corporations.
Are there other organizations doing this sort of thing that Goodweave does?
There are other organizations. There's a group of activists who have formed a label called Child Labor Free. That exists on some products. It hasn't picked up as much as Goodweave has. And then there are also companies such as Fairtrade. So Fairtrade is a labeling system that we see pretty much worldwide. It's in chocolates, it's in coffee beans, it's in tea production. And it's not perfect, but it's certainly one of the better ones out there. So if you're shopping and you have a choice between buying a box of chocolates or coffee beans that have a Fairtrade label versus one that doesn't, I would very much encourage you to pick up the one that says Fairtrade.
The ones that say Fairtrade cost more.
They do.
Do products that are made without child labor tend to cost more?
Yes, because they're actually paying their adult laborers. They're not using free labor. You know what's really interesting is there are approximately 200 million children around the world working as child laborers. And in 2016, the global unemployment number was 197 million. A lot of these 200 million children are oftentimes the very kids of these unemployed parents. So if we can take kids out of child labor, then it's going to create really significant economic opportunities and employment opportunities around the world. But of course, it will cost you.
Most of us live far away from India, Indonesia, and Ghana. And I'm wondering if this is the best way to do something about child labor, to demand that companies certify their products are child labor free or free trade.
Yes, that's certainly one way as well. We have a social impact campaign that is launching on our website, invisiblehandsmovie.com. That campaign launches tomorrow. And so if you go on our website, you'll be able to see ways in which you can take action, from helping to end child labor in this country in the tobacco fields, as well as helping you make smart shopping choices when you're buying food and beverage items.
The Harkin Engel Protocol was never enacted. Has there been any talk about bringing it up in Congress again?
There is. There are currently two bills that are sitting in Congress looking to tackle child labor in this country. However, there hasn't been any momentum on those bills. But we're really hoping that in the next 12 months, now that I've gone through the midterms and we have a Democratic House and a Republican Senate, that those bills will be picked up again.
Well, I'm wondering about tobacco, which is one of the biggest problems in this country. Mm-hmm. Tobacco is no longer a darling of American politicians. So why is tobacco still being protected in this one area?
That's a great question. What a lot of people don't know is that the tobacco lobbyists in this country, the agricultural lobbyists in this country, they are some of the most powerful lobbyists that we have in the United States, as powerful as the gun lobbyists. And we're talking an agricultural sector that has been in power since the years of, Franklin Roosevelt. And so when you have big money in politics, I mean, big money is essentially corrupt, but when you have big money and deep-pocketed lobbyists in this country, it's very hard to change laws.
And where are most of the tobacco farms located these days?
A lot of them are in North and South Carolina, Kentucky, Tennessee. That's where the largest sort of tobacco growing areas are in this country.
You've been showing this film before opening it for a opening next week and in New York in the Cinema Village. What's been the response of people who can actually do something?
The response, the first response I usually get, and I know there are some words I can't say on the show, so I'm not even going to tell you the verbatim response I receive, but the sentiment is,
oh, wow.
Yeah, I'm shocked. Mm. I cannot believe I just saw what I saw. I can't believe this is happening in this country. And pretty much the second or third question or comment right after that is, how can we help? How can we change this? How can we stop this?
Aren't groups like Human Rights Watch working to affect change?
They're fantastic. There's some great non-governmental organizations out there like Human Rights Watch, like Amnesty International, like UNICEF, like the ILO, the International Labor Organization, that are doing good work in this space.
Has this, doing this film, led you to your next project? Because you said your journalism led you to doing this.
Yes.
And I'm sure you discovered all sorts of things that came as a surprise as you were working on this.
Yes, absolutely. And that's a great question. So I did discover what my second film will be through the course of making this film.
You don't have to reveal it if you don't want to.
It's got nothing to do with child labor, but it has everything to do with human rights and genocide.
Ah. Oh, I look forward to another cheerful film.
Yes, absolutely. I'm very much establishing myself as a, just a lighthearted comedy filmmaker.
Tracy Tandon's film, which is called Invisible Hands, opens at the Cinema Village on November 23rd. And I thank you so much for coming by our show to talk about it.
Thank you so much. What an honor. And I look forward to being back next time with the next film. Yeah.
And that brings us to the end of today's show. My great thanks to Tracy Tandon, to Reggie Johnson, who was at the audio controls, to Charlie Morrow, who composed our theme music, and to my producer, Jesse Lent, who helps things run smoothly. Leonard Lopate at Large comes to you on Saturdays at 4 and Tuesdays at noon. You can subscribe to Leonard Lopate at Large podcast on iTunes and by clicking on Robin Hood Radio's archive program site, which is robinhoodradio.com. You can also check out Leonard Lopate at Large Facebook page. We hope to see you next week.